It's Marketplace Tech for Thursday the 16th. I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Ben Johnson. The motivations of the Orlando shooter remain murky. President Barack Obama said this week investigators had no information that the attack was directed by a foreign terrorist group. But the president confirmed the shooter looked at extremist information and propaganda over the internet. We reached out to Farah Pandith to find out more about online radicalization. She served on President George W. Bush's National Security Council team and in Hillary Clinton's State Department as Special Representative to Muslim Communities. She's now with Harvard and the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
What do we mean when we talk about online radicalization? What are these people looking for? What do they find online?
The internet is a place in which they can explore their identity in a real way. They see an opportunity to use what I call Shake Google to answer questions about belonging, about identity. Huh. So that those pieces are important because it means that the extremists are able to pull their ideology forward in a way that makes it accessible for these young people, but that the young people who are exploring who they are find answers on a wide range of things. It gives it reinforcement to their ideas. They see it visually, and they also see it and hear it through YouTube and other places.
So what strategies can researchers, nonprofits, the government use to maybe restructure this narrative or help these people who are seeking some sort of sense of identity and meaning find a different sense of identity and meaning?
So what we have failed to do in the 15 years since 9/11 is to scale up proportionally to the threat, the counter narratives that need to exist on and offline by credible, organic, local voices in all shapes and sizes that make a difference for this demographic. And so you see isolated attempts by not-for-profit organizations, by communities, by others to be able to build sort of resilience and other ideas. But it's not at the pace that the extremists are working. And so you're not seeing the kind of results that we really need.
Done well and with the proper resources, what would the sort of counter-narrative push look like?
So what I'd like to see is a re-evaluation of a 50-state national program in which we're looking at how to stop the kinds of extremist ideology that's coming in, and we can, if done right, see a significant change in the ability for these young people to push back when they see this coming across their screen.
Farah Pandith is Senior Fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
If you have a smartphone, you've probably received a wireless emergency alert, or WEA. They're those loud beeping messages that let you know about destructive weather, or amber alerts. Earlier in the week, we talked about the possibility of sending WEAs to alert people during a terrorist or mass shooter attack. One potential problem is that it's not possible to send a silent alert. So that means if you were hiding from attackers, the loud beep from your phone could tip them off. The Federal Communications Commission is the body that can make tweaks to the alerts, and it's in the process of considering some changes to WEAs, changes that include longer messages. Right now, they're limited to 90 characters, and targeting the messages to a smaller geographic range. But turning the sound off is not currently under consideration. The 2016 presidential primary season is over. Both major parties have their presumptive nominees. And now candidates have a choice whether and how much of their supported data to share with the party and with each other. By some estimates, Bernie Sanders has an email list of 5 million people, some of whom don't want their information shared. So will he? Won't he? And what's the norm? For answers, we reached out to Raed Ghani. He's the director of the Center for Data Science and Public Policy at the University of Chicago. He was also the chief scientist for the 2012 Obama campaign, focused on analytics and data. I asked him, what sort of information do these campaigns collect?
Well, at the base level, what they have is basically voting information about every registered voter in the country. So when you fill out your voter registration form, you put in your name, address, phone number. In addition, they might also have data that they collect when they interact with a particular voter, whether it's through fundraising, volunteering, or any other way. If they connect digitally, send them emails, sign up for a mailing list.
So do candidates traditionally share Will they share that data sort of later in the process?
I mean, there is no typically, you know, it is politics, so there's no typical way of doing things. Some campaigns do share information, some campaigns don't.
With the data you gathered and your team gathered in the 2012 campaign, where did that data go? Did you share it with the DNC?
So different levels of granularity get used or shared in different ways. Hmm. The data that the 2012 Obama campaign collected, a lot of it passed over to OFA, which is now Organizing for Action, and they're using it for a lot of the advocacy and fundraising work that they're doing. Some pieces of it DNC has access to, other pieces DNC does not have access to.
How valuable is this data in sort of today's political landscape?
It's not quite clear what the 5 million email addresses are valuable for. Now, in 2012, about $500 million that were raised by the Obama campaign were through a click that happened on an email address. So
$500 million with
valuable.
A B.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it is a big factor in fundraising and in volunteer recruiting. It's not necessarily a big factor in persuading people, because the people you're trying to persuade in different ways are really not on your email list.
Rai Ghani is director of the Center for Data Science and Public Policy at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ghani recommends checking the privacy policies of any campaign if you're worried about data sharing. We reached out to both the Clinton and Sanders campaigns for comment, but didn't hear back. I'm Adrienne Hill, and that's our show today. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.